From Tennessee to Washington, Vermont to Utah, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Heritage Foundation has released its 2025 Education Freedom Report Card. Jonathan Butcher of Heritage is here with details. The Schumer shutdown has entered its third week as Democrats refuse to put up the votes in the Senate to reopen the federal government. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Donald Trump is breathing new life into America's coal industry. Eric Boehm and Jeff Lucey of Reason Magazine are here to discuss. And after 17 years, Colin Hanna is retiring as an American Radio Journal commentator. He offers final thoughts and tells us who will be joining the program on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Education freedom has been making progress, but not all states are progressing equally. The Heritage Foundation has released its annual Education Freedom Report Card. Here with details is Jonathan Butcher. He is a senior fellow and acting director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jonathan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, tell us a bit about the Education Freedom Report Card. How long has Heritage been producing this research, and what is it all about?
Sure. The Heritage Education Freedom Report Card is a look at, as the title says, the degree to which parents can choose how and where their children learn in states. So it's not just how much money taxpayers spend or what the average test score is, although there are some indicators that account for those things. But we are more interested in the degree to which the education environment in a state allows for individuals to create new schools, allows for parents to choose where their children attend school or to educate them at home. So this is not just something that is looking at the inputs, right, in education. It's looking at the landscape. It's looking at the outputs, what we should think to see from education results in states across the U.S.
And what sort of metrics do you utilize to measure this?
First, of course, and as I was describing, it has to do with education choice. That's actually our first metric, and that is the degree to which parents can either choose a school or choose a set of learning options for a child. And then, even on top of that, the measure of just how flexible and expansive those education choice options are. So how many students are eligible, for example, for a private school scholarship program like an education savings account in a state? And then secondly, transparency, the measure to which we see states prohibiting DEI, states that are prohibiting the teaching of or requiring students to affirm critical race theory in school, or the school policies that would prohibit teachers from telling parents when a child comes to school and says they're confused about their sex. So all of these things, right, that provide a measure of just how transparent school systems are to the families whom they serve. Okay, so those are the first two. The next is teacher freedom, the ways in which individuals can leave, say, the private sector and enter the teaching profession and how easy that is. That's a key part of the teacher freedom measure. And then we have return on investment. So how do student scores go up or down based on how much money is spent in each state? So if you have a state, say Idaho, for example, who happens to rank number one on our return on investment, where their per student spending and student test scores indicate that the money is being used effectively, because you get a lot of student improvement for a small amount of taxpayer spending. And then finally, and this was a new measure added just this year, is civic education and what the requirements are for students to complete some sort of either test or coursework involved with civics before they finish high school. So those are our big measures.
Taking a look then at those particular metrics, let's talk about some of the all-stars. What states got an A on your report card?
We rank our states from 1 to 50 or 1 to 51, including D.C. Florida ranked first again this year. They've been first on our report card every year that we have done this. They rank first in education choice, which is really no surprise. Not only do they have several private and public school choice options for families, they are very expansive. They have wide eligibility provisions for students to participate. And not surprisingly, they have the largest population of students using one of these options, an education savings account or a private school scholarship to attend school. So Florida comes in first. Arizona is second. Idaho, Arkansas, and Louisiana round out the top five. Idaho just adopted a new private school choice option that we're excited to see the results of. Arkansas has a pretty new private school choice program. It's just a couple of years old. And Louisiana also has a pretty new private school choice option. So we are excited for just to see how many students these programs are going to serve.
And of course, to make the top five, there also has to be a bottom five. What states here, Jonathan, need some work?
It really shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. I mean, you've got New York, which spends upwards of $20,000+ per child and has significant gaps in achievement between students at the top and the bottom of the income scale. They also have virtually no private school choice options to speak of. Now, they have a charter school sector, but they so limit access to charter schools that it is really only for the fortunate few who get to use those schools. Oregon, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and Maine kind of round out 45 to 51. Places like Rhode Island have very small private school choice options. But, you know, you really should note Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont. I mean, these are all pretty big spenders when it comes to education spending. Connecticut, Massachusetts in particular. Oregon on the other side of the country, they are known for left of center policies that are not transparent to families. In fact, Oregon, they rank 32nd in transparency, 49th in teacher freedom, 41st in return on investment, as well as 45th in education choice. So these are states that they don't give parents many choices, and they actually make it very difficult for families to find a quality experience for their children.
Of course, education is largely a function of state and local governments here, Jonathan. Overall, if you were to take a look at the results of this year's Education Freedom Report card, looking back over the many years you've been doing it, are we generally moving in the right direction or are we off on the wrong course?
Well, I think we've seen more states adopt private school choice options. I mean, look, in Louisiana, they had a private school scholarship program that was highly restrictive, had significant regulations attached to them, and research actually found that the students participating were not doing well. And so a credit to the lawmakers in Louisiana, they disbanded that program and created a new education savings account. I mentioned already Idaho adopted a new program just this past year. We've seen Indiana expand their program. I mean, we've gone all this time already talking about it, and we haven't even mentioned Texas, right? Texas adopted a new education savings account this past year, which was a huge victory.
We have been talking with Jonathan Butcher, who is a senior fellow and acting director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jonathan, give us a few words about the Heritage Foundation. Also, if folks would like to read the 2025 Education Freedom Report Card, where can they find it?
You can find our report card at heritage.org, and we are a research think tank that's been in Washington, D.C. since the early 1970s, and we're trying to create an America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and civil society flourish. We handle not just education, but healthcare, foreign policy, relations with countries like China, the U.S. military, family-related issues, a wide variety of topics that are important to Americans around the country.
Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation. Jonathan, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. The federal government partial shutdown, as it were, continues. We also have some key U.S. Senate races all around the country starting to take shape. We're going to run those down. Scott, good to have you here.
It's my pleasure, Loman.
Let's start out with the shutdown. We're entering week 3. Doesn't appear like there's any end in sight, does there?
Speaker Johnson and the House Republicans have held firm in the fact that they passed a bill several weeks ago in September, and they have not returned to session since then. Their bill would keep the federal government open through November 21st, and that bill has been repeatedly voted down by Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats to cause this Schumer shutdown that we're all experiencing right now. I do think all across America, there's sort of business as usual, unless you're one of these federal workers that's been furloughed. And the bottom line is, President Trump and the administration, they've continued to put points on the board. We all saw the incredible peace agreement that he reached in the Middle East and the return of the 20 living hostages in Israel. And, you know, that's obviously a big accomplishment for President Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And I think that it actually gives them a lot of leverage because the media cannot ignore that element of the federal government continuing without really any hiccups. On the other hand, the Senate Democrats are fairly united behind Chuck Schumer. They have three in their caucus that have voted with the Republicans to try to reopen the government alongside that Republican House CR that we talked about a minute ago. But in the meantime, Chuck Schumer is sort of saying, hey, we want to extend these Obamacare subsidies that expire at the end of 2025. And these aren't just the Affordable Care Act subsidies that were extended to low-income individuals that couldn't purchase health insurance from Obamacare. This was an expanded provision in that law from the 2020 COVID pandemic and in 2021 with the Biden stimulus. Joe Biden and a partisan majority of Democrats basically enhanced those credits so that wealthier people could see their premiums offset through really deficit spending. And it's incredibly expensive. It's over $400 billion for just this provision over 10 years. And I think that there's a lot of people that say, you know what, Lohman, COVID is over. There is no emergency there. The reason that premiums are high is because Democrats have destroyed the health insurance market by limiting choice and competition in the marketplace and basically having this regulatory regime that ensures sick people are subsidized by healthy people. And that's basically what the condition of pre-existing conditions and guaranteed coverage means in Obamacare. And they've extended that well beyond the targeted population that Obama wanted to cover because of the COVID pandemic.
Well, we will continue to keep an eye on all of that. Meanwhile, let's take a look at a couple of the key U.S. Senate races that have had some major developments or starting to shape up. The state of Texas looks like a very competitive intramural going on there. What's happening in the Lone Star State?
Texas has a filing deadline, I believe, in December 15th or so. And what happened recently was a U.S. congressman from the Houston area, Wesley Hunt, got in the race, making this a three-way race between current U.S. Senator Republican John Cornyn, who has served several terms in the Senate. And he's being primaried as well by a popular attorney general, Ken Paxton. And, you know, for a long time, people thought maybe that'll be a head-to-head race. There had been rumors that Wesley Hunt would get in the race for about 6 months, and he finally pulled the trigger. And what that probably means, Lohman, is this thing's going to go to a runoff. In Texas, in order to win the Republican nomination, you have to finish above 50%. And the polling shows that with these three candidates, it's pretty unlikely that somebody's going to get over 50%. And in a three-way race, it'll be quite interesting to see who the final two are to duke it out in May for that Republican nomination. There's going to be a ton of money spent here. Obviously, the National Republican Senatorial Committee and the Senate Leadership Fund, they have a responsibility to try to defend the Republican incumbents. Meanwhile, I think you have two very, very strong candidates that are taking Cornyn on, and that'll be one that the Club for Growth and our PACs continue to watch.
Another state to continue watching, the state of Kentucky. We have Senator Mitch McConnell, longtime U.S. Senator there, former majority leader in the U.S. Senate. He is retiring, so we have an open seat. That's always interesting.
Yeah, Certainly it is. In this instance, you have a candidate named Daniel Cameron, who was previously the Attorney General of Kentucky, and he ran for governor in 2023. You might recall that Kentucky is one of those states that sort of has this weird off-year election schedule, so their next gubernatorial race will be in 2027. Daniel Cameron was the nominee there, and he lost a tight race to Andy Beshear. So he's got incredible name ID and is given it another shot at statewide office. He'll be running against Andy Barr, a U.S. congressman from Kentucky. And then there's also a businessman named Nate Morris. And Nate Morris has sort of a unique background because he's pretty connected with Donald Trump Jr. and Vice President J.D. Vance. Folks are wondering, is President Trump going to weigh in this primary? I think that it's an exciting one to watch. Obviously, with Cameron's name ID, he'll be leading in the public polling right now. But President Trump has to make a decision on whether he's going to be neutral, whether he's going to support Morris or another candidate. And we'll be watching that one pretty closely as well. The Club for Growth PACs have been spending against Andy Barr in that race so far. And his record in Congress has been pretty mediocre in our opinion on the economic issues. And we want to make sure that we can get somebody in there that really defends the idea of freedom and liberty and opportunity in America.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We are united in that idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity that I sort of mentioned during the Kentucky race. But if you want to learn more about the candidates that we've already endorsed all throughout America or about our mission, please visit clubforgrowth.org. And you can also follow us on X at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The war on fossil fuels was devastating to the coal industry, but the Trump administration has reversed that course, as we learn from Eric Boehm and Jeff Lucey of Reason Magazine.
Well, it's no big secret that President Joe Biden was a big fan of green energy, loved throwing taxpayer dollars and subsidies at promoting renewable energy. Since President Donald Trump returned to office in January, there's been a shift in federal energy policy, and as my guest will explain today, President Trump's attempts to promote and subsidize coal production certainly has its benefits for the coal industry, but also repeats some of the same mistakes that Biden made, just, of course, in the opposite direction. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Jeff Luce. He is a deputy managing editor for us at Reason, and he follows these energy and environmental issues for us as well, writes about them regularly. His latest piece in the November issue of the magazine is headlined, "Donald Trump is the Coal President." That sums it up pretty well. Jeff, thanks for taking some time and joining us here on the program.
Of course, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with what the Trump administration has done. You follow this stuff very closely. I know most people probably don't. Walk us through a bit of what the Energy Department and the Interior Department have done to promote coal since Trump came back into office.
In April, Trump issued an executive order titled to reinvigorate America's beautiful clean coal industry. So in that executive order, he directed a whole bunch of federal agencies, specifically the Energy Department and the Interior Department, to identify different regulations and different things that get in the way of coal production, especially on federal lands. So as a result of that executive order, the Energy Department opened up a whole bunch of financing opportunities for coal. So that includes access to its own loan programs office. It also designated coal as a critical material, which that has implications for permitting as well as federal grants. And then the Interior Department, meanwhile, has really fast-tracked coal production on federal lands. They opened up a whole bunch of land for coal mining that had previously been closed. And meanwhile, while they're doing all this, they're axing permitting for renewables. They're canceling projects that were previously approved. So really, it's all just been kind of this big coal subsidy thing, while they're really just disincentivizing the production of renewables.
I like the idea of speeding up permitting or removing some of these regulatory barriers that have previously been put in place. I mean, allowing coal to compete with other forms of energy. That all sounds good to me. On the other hand, it sounds like the Trump administration is also, as you detail in this piece here, it's also kind of putting its thumb on the scale in a way that maybe is doing more than just letting coal compete against other forms of energy, but is actually giving a kind of distorting some of these markets in a way that I think kind of reflects some of what Biden did in a different direction.
Yeah, definitely. And as we know, under Biden, we saw a massive influx of green energy credits, energy tax credits, and subsidies. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act did end quite a few of those, although I have issues with how they did that. For instance, they didn't outright cancel a lot of these subsidies. They just kind of sped up their expiration date, which, as we know in D.C., lobbyists are going to take advantage of that. And so to your point, it's not like he kind of came in and said, oh, wow, the playing field's really tilted towards renewables. Let's just kind of even it all out. He kind of came in and said, all right, it's tilted towards renewables, but I don't like that. Let's tilt it towards coal and other fossil fuels. So it's really trading one bad policy in for another.
We're chatting with Jeff Luce. He's the deputy managing editor for us at Reason Magazine, talking about and he follows, you know, energy policy. This is really your area of expertise here, Jeff. And that's why I wanted to have you on to talk about this, because, look, obviously, energy costs are very important to everyone, to American businesses, to consumers. We all have to use electricity in some way, shape or form. And this is the thing that kind of drives me crazy about this, is that you have, you know, what you just described there of this sort of seesaw action of it goes one administration favors one type of energy. A new administration comes in and favors a different type of energy. Like, the best thing here, in my mind, for taxpayers, for ratepayers, for all of us, would just be to have more of all energy. Is there a reason we can't just do that?
I agree. I wish we could do that, and it makes the most sense. But D.C. lobbying, it's really whoever has the most money, right? And whoever has the ear of the president. And this is the same thing that happened in Trump's first term. In his first term, he didn't go through with it, but he really hinted at doing some coal subsidies, some coal buyouts. And really, it's just like, it must just be that the coal industry has his ear. And the green industry, unfortunately for them, doesn't have Trump's ear. But it's just a repetitive thing in D.C. A politician goes in and like truly tries to go all of the above and truly tries to decrease the amount of market distorting subsidies that are out there.
Yeah, and I mean, we could talk about this for a lot longer, but look, I mean, I would love to see more of everything. We didn't even get a chance to talk about nuclear here, but I'd love to see more of that as well. And I'd like to see the government less involved in all of it, because, of course, once you do have the government making these types of decisions about what kind of energy Americans get, well, then the lobbyists get involved and they influence those decisions, and the outcomes are what they are here. You end up with this seesawing effect from one administration to the next, and that doesn't really help anybody. We are unfortunately out of time for today, though, Jeff. Thanks for taking some time and walking us through all this.
Thanks, Eric.
And once again, that is Jeff Luce. He is a deputy managing editor for us at Reason, and he covers these energy issues for us at Reason.com and in the magazine. Check out his latest piece in the November issue of the magazine, Donald Trump is the Coal President. That's the headline on that. And of course, you can also check out everything else we're working on this week at Reason.com. I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
On this edition, we say farewell to Colin Hanna, who has been a regular commentator on this program since its inception in 2008. We here at American Radio Journal wish to express our deep appreciation to Colin for the insightful commentaries he has offered over the years. He offers some final thoughts on this American Radio Journal commentary.
17 years ago, Loman Henry invited me to supply a 5-minute commentary on the political subject of my choice to his then new syndicated radio program, American Radio Journal. I was honored to be asked and have enjoyed the opportunity ever since. However, all good things come to an end, and I have decided that today's will be my last contribution to the program. In that time, American Radio Journal has grown to over 280 radio stations around the country. As its host, Loman has produced a remarkable product, a true service to the American public, by assembling a cadre of writers, scholars, elected officials, and subject experts on everything from economic policy to foreign policy, cultural trends, constitutional issues, political philosophies, and elections. All of these topics have been addressed from the perspective of what Ronald Reagan famously defined in his Time for Choosing speech: limited government, free markets, a strong national defense, and traditional values. Lohman has maintained the intellectual integrity of these, updating them without diluting them, because they are rooted in truth, and truth is durable, not trendy. I'm delighted that Keith Rothfuss, a former member of Congress whom I'm proud to call a friend, will be succeeding me as one of American Radio Journal's tri-weekly commentators. Keith and I first met in 2012 when he was a candidate for Congress. I've met quite a few candidates for Congress over the years, and I suspect many of you listeners to American Radio Journal have also. Most of them are wrapped up in themselves and exude a kind of non-stop artesian pride whenever they speak. I once attributed that phenomenon to the fact that a political candidate is both salesperson and product. Many of them fall in love with their product, themselves. Few are better at listening than they are at speaking. Keith is one of the few exceptions to that rule. He is attentive, thoughtful, analytical, principled, and courteous. He has been properly described as a servant leader. That's a rare quality. Jesus Christ will always be known as the greatest servant leader in history, and while Keith is no Jesus, he's a lot closer than most. It's no surprise that he's also a man of quiet but solid faith. I look forward to hearing his commentaries right here on this program. I leave the program at a fascinating time in American history. Last week, we saw President Donald Trump succeed where his more conventional predecessors failed, achieving a ceasefire with the potential to grow into a lasting peace in the Middle East. He has radically shifted his position on the Russia-Ukraine war to one that I believe is more realistic than his earlier naive embrace of Vladimir Putin. His tariffs may prove to have beneficial foreign policy effects in addition to their economic effects, although some were probably too hastily conceived and therefore subject to numerous unsettling later tweaks. But he's proving to be right when most of his detractors are looking wrong. He has profoundly reset Americans' views on illegal immigration, even while turning a somewhat blind eye to human rights abuses in implementing immigration reforms and deportation strategies. He has broadened the applications of Reagan's famous peace through strength concept from one largely focused on foreign policy to one that incorporates economic strength as well as military strength. And yet not even his most ardent supporters would ever suggest that Donald Trump is better at listening than he is at talking. He is indeed on his way to becoming the single most consequential president of our lifetimes, with not all of those consequences necessarily being beneficial ones. The risks of fomenting such widespread disruption and instability are high, and yet the long-term goals of worldwide peace and prosperity are unlikely to be reached within the confines of accepted practice. In short, he cannot be characterized with one or two catchwords. The next few years may be a wild ride for our nation and the world. Keith Rothfuss, Paul Kenger, Jonathan Williams, Lohman Henry, and the rest of America Radio Journal's staff and guests are well positioned to make sense of it all. I will be listening regularly and intently. So it is with optimism and the durability of our principles that I take my leave. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring, signing off.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WOLF-FM in Syracuse, New York. Welcome to our new listeners in the Empire State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Lohman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.